All right. Looks like it's 9:15. We have a lot of people starting to join, so I'll give it like another 30 seconds or so, and then I'll get started.
Good morning.
Good morning.
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 So, Will, I'm curious, did you use ChatGPT?
I did not actually. I tried using it a little bit the same way Matt had talked about, and I just didn't like the output of the summaries. I didn't think they were particularly helpful.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, thanks. I don't know when I'm coming up, and I wondered what I was going to do, but I'm kind of interested in people's experience. By the way, we have likely a couple of visitors, one from Brazil and one from Houston. So they'll be joining. I sent them the link. So if you're wondering who the extra folks are, Ludi and Luis.
Welcome.
I also shared the link with a medical student, Jessica, who's rotating with me today, who's interested in pathology.
Oh, great.
All right, so can everyone see the Word document then?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, so actually there weren't a ton of articles like histopathology driven articles relevant to pulmonary pathology specifically. In December, it was stuff that's more broadly applicable to pathology or like clinical or radiographic papers on ILD and things like that. So I ended up picking out four things. I think the first one here is the most interesting and directly relevant to everyday practice, especially for those that are moving into digital pathology. So this is from a group in I think it's Mount Sinai and Yale and a couple other places in the Northeast, but the lead author here is Hagigi. So this looked at digital pathology detection of infectious microorganisms specifically with IHC staining or histochemical staining, so special stains. And the special stains they used here were GMS, GIMSA, Mucocarmine, and Zeal-Nielsen. I'm going to focus our discussion today on GMS, Mucocarmine, and Zeal-Nielsen, because for the most part, we're not going to be using these other ones in the lung, but all that info on those is there in the paper for anyone that does any of these other subspecialties where those are relevant. So what they did was they picked out six pathologists. They wanted to look at the overall diagnostic statistics here, sensitivity, specificity, all that, and the inter-rater reliability between those six people. So what they did is they first got a big group of all the cases where any of these stains had been ordered, whether it was histochemical or IHC, from, dating back to 2010. And then they went through and they wanted to pick out an equal number of positive and negative cases to have a good representation of positives. So they went with 100 for all these stains here, including GMS, and then they picked out 20 cases of Cryptococcus and ones with acid fast bacilli on Zeal-Nielsen. So that would be 10 positives, 10 negatives, 10 positives, 10 negatives here. Here's their full list of how many cases they picked out for each one. You can actually see that they put the size of the microorganism in microns there, just kind of as a reference. So they scanned all of these slides at 40x. There was no Z stacking, so they couldn't actually focus in and out of plane. All digital images here were reviewed by six people, so they were blinded to the original diagnosis. They all had pretty limited digital pathology experience, and all of these people were in practice. There weren't any trainees involved in the group. So there were two hematopathologists, one oral pathologist, one cytopathologist, one GI person, and somebody who does neuro. So they reviewed the order was randomized, and then none of these were from cell blocks or other cytology type samples. So they could document their interpretation as either positive or negative, but they could also do equivocal. So that was an option for these two. So the reference standard here was the original interpretation at the time of the initial diagnostic evaluation. And they went through all the positive cases and made sure that they were things that most people would call positive and they weren't equivocal type findings. I don't think they went through all the negative cases and made sure they were truly negative. The diagnostic statistics here were calculated by pooling the results from all six people, and then equivocal results were left out of that particular part of the analysis. The Fleiss Kappa was used for agreement between the observers. And lastly, they did this interesting color contrast ratio measurement between the organism and then the background you'll find that organism in. And this is, something you can only do in a digital setting. You can't really measure this with a microscope because you need a computer to be able to tell you how different your organism is from the background it's found in. So as an example, they use this online tool, and this online tool gives you an example of what high contrast would be. So this is a ratio of 21 to 1. Black on white or white on black will give you this very high ratio. This is as high as it can go. And then a very low contrast ratio would be somewhere around 1 to 1 is the worst. So of course, white on yellow is terrible to look at, and it gives you a low ratio. So what they found, first of all, 8.5% of all the slides that they had originally collected were unsatisfactory for scanning. So they only got 620 slides that were actually scanned and they were able to look at in the end. In terms of their statistics, I just focused again on GMS, Mesocarmine, and Ziehl-Neelsen. GMS was pretty good across the board. Of course, you're never going to get 100% accuracy or sensitivity when you have six different people reviewing things. So for me, these are quite high, and it says to me that GMS is reliable. There's no reason to think that people are going to be missing things or misinterpreting things on GMS. As far as Mesocarmine and Ziehl-Neelsen, though, there were a lot of false negatives. So that drove down the sensitivity here and also drove down the negative predictive value. So there were a lot of cases of acid fast bacilli missed here, as well as Mesocarmine. Crypto, I guess I would say, on Mesocarmine. And then their equivocal call rate was around 5%. No big outliers here in terms of the different organisms. 85% of those equivocal interpretations were just from three of the people. So half of the pathologists accounted for the vast majority of these equivocal calls. And then in terms of their agreement between the people, GMS, they rated a substantial based on, so this number here for Fleiss Kappa corresponds to what they would call substantial agreement. And then for the other two stains, they were more in the moderate range. In terms of that color contrast evaluation, it turns out GMS has very good contrast. So black on that light green gives you a ratio of around 12 and a half, which is pretty good. It's the highest in this whole group. And then crypto, if you're looking at a bright pink organism in just in a white space, the contrast seems okay, but in the background of tan, so if you have actual tissue that the organism's right next to, the contrast ratio is pretty low. Then for Ziehl-Neelsen, it's kind of a moderate range. It's more on the lower side, though. 2.7 to 1 is the ratio. So to me, the take-home messages here were it looks like there's a high false negative rate, which corresponds to a low sensitivity when you're looking at Ziehl-Neelsen's or Mesocarmine on digitized slides. So to me, that false negative rate is pretty high. I would go straight to just looking at these the old-fashioned way still. Now, what they didn't do was take these six people and have them relook at these slides, at a later date, or have some kind of a comparison group where they're using a microscope and a glass slide to see if their sensitivity would be equally low or if it would be better. So they didn't, in terms of the reference standard, they were picking out things that had already been called positive, right? So I would have liked to see them take these six people and have them do something very similar, but with glass slides and a microscope. And then assessing GMS to me does not really seem problematic. on digitized slides based on this data. And then about somewhere around 5% of the results were deemed equivocal. So what I was going to ask the group about is I don't look at digital slides clinically almost ever, especially for microorganisms, but for people who have mostly moved over to digital pathology, what are you doing in terms of when you're using special stains on a scope versus digitally?
I
This is Andras.
Yeah.
So actually it gives us some reassurance because this is exactly what we do. We are fully digital, so we look at everything digitally except for the special stains for organisms. So it's also helpful to me to know that GMS is accurate most of the time, but it sounds like if GMS is negative digitally, then we probably still need to look at the glass slide because missing one of 10 is not as stellar.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Yeah.
I can add too with my experience. So, I mean, we have all of our slides scanned, but I typically will look at glass. But I have done some comparisons, and I have several cases where I found the exact area where you can see the acid fast bacillus on the glass slide, and I found it on the digital scan, and it is not there. I kind of saved those cases like this is why you shouldn't look at AFB on scan slides.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see this has actually been published, but this fits completely with my experience and my anecdotal couple of cases.
Yeah, Henry, did you have your?
Yeah, did they talk at all about the GMS cases that were problematic? I mean, I think the ones that were, again, like Yasmin, I will occasionally look at them because I'm out at the hospital and, the stains aren't back yet, and I kind of want to see whether I can find something and get the case signed out before the slides show up. And so, did they talk about like how many organisms, like histo, small, amounts of histo can be the kinds of cases where it's problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think they talked about it, but I know exactly what you're talking about when you've got a huge area of necrosis and maybe two organisms
Right.
or something. And they didn't specifically go into any more detail about those cases.
Okay, thanks.
One
In
more
my
comment from
experience,
me. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Go
No
ahead,
problem. My experience is like Jasmine's. I
Henry.
do see fungi on the GMS, but if I don't see it, I do look at the glass slides and AFB. I mean, we have it screened by the Cytotec, so I think they do a pretty good job. And then when I compare it to the digital, I often do not see the AFB positivity. So I do think we need to look at the glass.
Yeah, that's what it's sounding like, both, statistically and anecdotally. So.
I was going to make one other comment about GMS. I mean, I completely agree with the sentiments that have already been shared. That mirrors my experience very much, that I don't trust digital whatsoever for AFB. But one thing that isn't really conveyed by their data in this study is how variable GMS can be. On a very clean GMS, I think it's very reasonable to expect that you can see the organisms on digital. We've struggled in our lab to have a good clean GMS at times, and on those dirty GMSs, and we all kind of know what that means, it can be impossible to interpret digital. So it really is dependent upon a high quality stain, which isn't always, the case, and unfortunately, in real practice.
Yeah, for
Yeah,
sure.
I was going to ask how does it handle those cases with all the anthracotic pigments? What does it do with all that?
They didn't, again, did not specifically go into details about things like they didn't get very granular, we'll put it that way, with what specific cases were problematic and what limited sensitivity.
Because lung cases are often a real problem with GMS, the antithrombotic pigment, and sometimes just mucus seems to stain with
Yeah.
it. And so it's all very important to, it's so important to know about the shape of what you're looking at, isn't it? It's that's key.
Yeah, absolutely. Even red blood cells, neutrophils, collagen
Yeah.
sometimes, depending on how crushed things are. No, but they were, I think they were somewhat limited by how many different stains they were looking at here. And it didn't allow them to get into the weeds as much with specific problem areas for identifying or, confidently saying their organism's present or not present in any specific stain that they were looking at. So.
What would be useful if we had fluorescence for oramino for AFBs, and then you could image it fluorescently, and then you don't have to be sitting there in the dark room looking for it yourself. So that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering
I
how
wonder
people
how well it
so
would do.
often a portion of our group signs out from home pretty regularly, and I'm always curious about their workflow. Does anybody do that and find, I mean, I would find it rather annoying to think I could sign out a case and be done and then have to go in the next day and remember, oh, I have to look at that AF, especially if they're not delivering the slides to your office because you want to sign out digitally, which is how it is with our group that signs out digitally, I think, but I don't really know what the workflow is because I don't do it.
Yeah.
I can't comment on that part, Henry. But one thing I will mention, my experience is exactly the same as everybody else has already articulated. I would only add to that for AFB staining in particular, I've noticed a real difference between the kind of the two major breeds of scanners that we use. Certainly, when we're talking about our Primana scanners that are doing our archival scanning, the Z stacking algorithm is so much better with that I find the sensitivity for detecting AFB a lot better on those archival studies or on those archival scans than they are on our prospective scans with our GT450s. So I think it's really entirely dependent on how well the scanner and how many Z stacks it's doing, how many layers it's condensing down into the visible layer, and how good it's picking up kind of on those subtle things. And Primana's, in my opinion, is just superior. And so I would hope that as we see the technology progress over the next few years, this will get better. And I fully anticipate that it will. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. It's not all bleak, I think.
Yeah, and they know, I think they note somewhere, maybe at the end of the paper or something, that things, obviously the technology can change and improve, but for now there are these limitations.
So, Joe, does that stacking help you look at, often when I'm looking at a tough case where you want the cytology, does it actually help because of the Z stacking that you can sort of focus up and down? Because
Not
if
really,
40S is
no.
not very good often, when on a really tough
Yeah.
low-grade adeno.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And then, I mean, it's made further complicated by the fact that you get that non-optical, you get the digital zoom too, that goes up to like 60x, and that actually looks pretty terrible on a lot of
Yeah,
these things.
right.
But no, it doesn't help you because you're not able to kind of scroll the wheel up and down. And unfortunately, especially with fungal organisms, I guess I never realized how much I count and rely on the refractile qualities of that, of fungi. I mean, I guess it makes sense when I say it out loud and when you do talk about it with other people, but it's one of those things that I think is largely subconscious as you're looking under a microscope, but you miss it a lot when you're looking at the digital slide. But the Z stacking algorithm, what it does is it basically scans at multiple layers and then it picks the one that it's identifying the most kind of discriminating properties. So getting back to what that contrast discussion was at the very beginning of the paper, that's how the algorithm basically applies it. So when it sees something with a little bit of pink in the field, it picks that one to show you rather than the ones that are showing you nothing. And so that's really where the benefit comes in, not in your ability to kind of use the wheel and kind of scroll up and down, unfortunately. So that's where the improvement is made. But I think you're right. For digital pathology to kind of ultimately reach parity with, you know, optical microscopic stuff, we're going to need some kind of function that allows us to kind of get, kind of assess a little bit more of the three dimensionality of things. And, you know, I think that's going to be, that will come. It's just going to take time.
No, that's great to hear that, you know, there's variation in scanning, because not all of us are involved in the conversations, of course, with what scanner we're getting next or what are the capabilities of our scanners at any given institution. And I don't, to be honest, I'm not sure with what we're using now, whether we have those, you know, Z stacking that you were describing. So we can move on to the next one unless anyone has any other questions or comments on that one. So this was a paper looking at deep learning models for identifying metastatic squamous cell carcinoma and predicting it from whole slide images. So of course, there are tons of papers that have done similar things, and even some that have done this with adeno already. So what they wanted to do was design and validate this deep learning model to identify squamous cell carcinoma in lymph node dissection specimens. And what they actually started off with for their training set was a bunch of primary tumor slides. So they took 2,400 squamous cell carcinoma positive slides from different primary sites. So this included skin, esophagus, head and neck, lung. And then they took what they called 4,000 non-neoplastic lesion slides. And they don't even explain what those are actually. But they don't have squamous cell carcinoma in them. That's all we know. So these were derived from five different hospitals in Japan. And then they actually took some of the TCGA slides from online and used those as well in part of their training set, just I think to add more numbers to that. And then they did a validation phase where they had 30 more positive cases and 30 more negative cases. Again, these were primary tumor. And then for their test set, they had 41 case slides with squamous cell carcinoma on them. And these were lymph nodes. So these were all from lymph node dissections that came along with a cancer resection, whether it was head and neck, esophagus, or lung. And then they had 500 negative lymph node slides. So all these were scanned at 20x. And then as far as the deep learning modeling, they have a really good explanation. I can't pretend to understand all the details of it and what they did computationally. But basically, the way I understand is they trained the model to evaluate small tiles one at a time, basically, and assign each one of those tiles in a slide from the test set a probability of having squamous cell carcinoma in that tile. And then overall, it tells you, you know, the how many slides, you know, had squamous cell carcinoma in them. So the probability in any given one of these tiles goes from 0 to 1. If it's above 0.5, they call it positive. And if it's below 0.5, the model calls it negative. So pretty straightforward with, you know, regards to positive and negative calls. But again, how that probability is decided on is beyond my ability to explain this stuff. So overall, the model actually did pretty well at finding squamous cell carcinoma. What it didn't do well at is not overcalling squamous cell carcinoma like crazy. So the overall AUC here is 0.94, which is pretty respectable. The log loss is basically a measurement of how confident the model is and how it's kind of a correlate of how well the model's doing. A low number means it's making good confident calls that are close to 0 or close to 1, is my understanding of this. So if it makes a bunch around 0.5, that number is going to be higher. So this apparently is a pretty respectable number from what I could find. The accuracy overall was about 0.88. So the main limiting factor here in what the model was calling is that the positive predictive value was really low because it had tons of false positives. So F1 score is kind of another way to look at accuracy here. But you can see the overall numbers here. The sensitivity is okay at 0.93. Specificity is not great, but it's okay. But then when you look at the positive predictive value in terms of all the positives it's calling, how many are false positives? It's very high. And here's why. So you've got 38 things that it called true positives, but 63 things that it overcalled that were non-neoplastic. And then in terms of things that it missed, it only missed three areas of squamous cell carcinoma out of, you know, all the true negatives it had were 437. So of these false positives, these 63 things that it was overcalling as squamous cell carcinoma, a lot of it was crush artifact, about half of it. And then germinal centers made up for about 25% overall, and then histiocytic aggregates with anthracotic pigment, and then vessels, and then 18 of them they decided were just unexplained. It didn't know why it was flagging it as squamous cell carcinoma. The false negatives, so they had three of those, and these were cases of what they called poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinoma. So here are some examples of what it missed. These, I'm not quite sure why it would miss these and pick up so many other things. This I can kind of see because it's a little bit, it's subtle and it's melded into the lymphoid tissue a little bit more. But these seem like pretty discrete nests. So for me here, the take-home point is deep learning models, it could be effective screening tools for lymph nodes. Of course, we're not even, I don't think, close to being there yet. But particularly because they have this really low false negative rate. It's not missing a lot of things. What it's doing is just overcalling, at least for this particular model. So the overall accuracy of the model is limited by high false positives. Any questions about that one or comments?
Thank you, Will. Very interesting. I was wondering, what was the smallest deposit of squamous cell carcinoma in the lymph node that they found? Did they say anything about it? Because what you show here as far as negative, they are kind of even on the larger side. But what's the smallest they can detect?
I am not sure. They have some figures. Let me see if I can find some areas where they were able to find small things. I'd have to look back through. I don't know that they mention kind of its limit of detection, if you will, of like how few cells or how small of a nest it can pick up. But I can,
it'd be interesting to know if it could get individual tumor cells or not, just thinking from like a breast carcinoma perspective.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, especially post-treatment or something. Is it on the PDF now?
Yes, we see the PDF.
Tell from my Zoom setup here. But yeah, it picks up. So this is an example of how it creates probabilistic output from all these different tiles. So each one of these would be a tile. And then I believe red would be, I think that corresponds from what I remember to a high likelihood of having squamous cell carcinoma in it. So, you know, of course, all of this, I think this is from one of their, no, this is from a lymph node. But yeah, this, it'll pick up these individual tiles, but I'm not sure how small of a focus it's able to work with.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So people are still working on this AI stuff, and we'll probably keep hearing about it. So next one is on this IHC marker called Schlafen 11. I'd never heard of this until the other day. So this is basically the background on this is that it's this DNA RNA helicase. This protein regulates cellular response to injury, basically, and the injury of interest here is chemotherapy, specifically cytotoxic chemotherapy that does its job by damaging DNA in some way. So people have been looking at this in both preclinical in vitro studies as well as now ongoing clinical trials, and they've shown that the Schlafen-11 expression is associated with increased tumor sensitivity to these types of chemotherapeutic drugs, as well as PARP inhibitors. But there are several ongoing trials apparently right now for specifically for small cell, and positive Schlafen-11 IHC is one of the criteria for inclusion in those specific trials. So what they wanted to do is evaluate this IHC staining in a huge variety of different epithelial, mesenchymal, and neuroectodermal tumors, and then compare them also to a couple normal tissue controls. So they had almost 4,000 epithelial tumors, almost 3,000 mesenchymal and/or neuroectodermal tumors arranged in these multi-tissue paraffin blocks. I don't know whether these were actually just tissue microarrays or if they were larger chunks of tissue all put together in one block. They don't specify that in the paper. So all these tumors, they were not treated previously. It was not specified whether they were from a primary site, metastatic site, or things like that, but they were treatment naive. So the clone they were using is this anti-Schlafen-11 D2 mouse monoclonal from Santa Cruz. And basically, in terms of reviewing the staining, they just estimated the percentage of total tumor cells with nu so it's a nuclear stain with nuclear staining. They didn't specify that it had to be a certain intensity, and then they categorized them basically as having like none or less than 10%, so low staining, and then 10 to 79% that was considered in the medium or moderate range, and then more than 80% they called diffuse. And it was unclear who was doing this, whether it was one person, multiple pathologists, wasn't specified. In terms of their table of all these different tumors, I just picked out the ones that are relevant in the chest. And I highlighted here the ones with really high Schlafen-11 expression. So small cell, about three quarters of them have expressed this antibody, a lot of which have it expressed diffusely. So majority of that was diffuse. Also for mesothelioma, very high expression rates here for Schlafen-11, and those were also diffuse in most cases. And then the other tumors here that did have some expression were adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and then also thymic carcinomas. And these were more of a mixed bag in terms of how diffusely the tumor was staining. Carcinoids didn't have any expression. They didn't find any cases with even a small amount of expression of this antibody. As far as normal background tissues, it seems like you'll find kind of spotty focal weak to intermediate staining in a variety of epithelial cells, no matter what site you're in. That includes bronchial epithelium and pneumocytes. Normal endothelial cells and a fraction of normal lymphocytes will be positive, and that will be moderate to strong. So those need to be ignored. Take-home message here is that so both small cell and mesothelioma have really high rates of expression of this antibody, more than 90% of those cases, and often with diffuse expression, while the other carcinomas that we're accustomed to looking at in the lung had rates that were more in the moderate range, both in terms of the degree of expression throughout any given tumor and the total number of tumors in that category that were expressing Schlafen-11. So it's unclear whether this will actually end up having clinical utility, but it's something to keep an eye on because it is being worked on in clinical trials. And one thing they'll have to determine at some point is what good cutoffs are for this antibody. I don't know if anyone is involved in any of this stuff with this particular antibody or has heard of it before, but be interested to see if anyone's heard of it before. All
No,
right.
and no one had asked to develop it in the IHC lab.
Okay.
That doesn't mean much, but
Yeah, it could happen overnight, like we see sometimes where all of a sudden everyone wants it on every case. But that is We'll see. The next one is just one I wanted to show because I thought it was an interesting, histopathologic group of cases here that looked diagnostically tricky. This, I actually went a little bit off the beaten path to find. It was in Annals of Diagnostic Pathology. But they present these five cases of SFT with what they call small cell features. They kind of just look neuroendocrine in general, but these looked really tricky from a morphology perspective. So I just wanted to share this paper. So all five of these cases were from MD Anderson path collection. They performed these stains on all cases. So they did a cytokeratin, they did STAT6, CD34, and then they did neuroendocrine markers, as well as TTF1, NAPSIN, and some muscle markers. So most of these cases were kind of middle to older age adults, four women, one man, three were in the pleura, two were actually in the lung, one was endobronchial. All these patients presented with symptoms, and they were around 5 centimeters for the most part. So they had, and I'll pull up the images here of the tumor. So here's the endobronchial one. So you can see they have this kind of anastomosing nests in the background of this really vascular and somewhat sclerotic stroma. Here's the tumor from low power. It's a little bit ill-defined for a solitary fibrous tumor. And then here you can kind of see where it's got this nested pattern that can mimic a neuroendocrine tumor, particularly like carcinoid type cytomorphology in images like this. And then here is their STAT6 for one of the cases. And then these are neuroendocrine markers. So here's synaptophysin, INSM1 has a little bit of focal scattered positivity, and then CD56 has some positivity in that particular case. And not all cases had neuroendocrine expression. So they had synaptophysin and CD56 were focally positive in two of the intrapulmonary cases. And then one of those also had that INSM1 focal reactivity. All of the markers there were negative. So two of these were classified as intermediate risk based on the criteria that most of us use from the that paper that's looked at features of malignancy in SFT. So the main problem here was that of four of these tumors had no areas that looked like conventional growth patterns for solitary fibrous tumor. It was only seen in one case where they had, bland spindle cells with this patternless growth pattern. And then dilated HPC like or staghorn vessels were not prominent in most of these cases. And then they noted that they didn't see any areas of what they call dedifferentiation in any of them. So just wanted to share that one because solitary fibrous tumors, as we know, they are pretty heterogeneous. Most of them, of course, will have that bland spindle cell morphology, but they can look like a lot of things. I've come to appreciate how variable they can be by going to our bone and soft tissue like teaching conference, and they once a month probably they bring something that I would have never thought of solitary fibrous tumor on my differential. So and then everything else down here is stuff for notation that's probably not as practically relevant unless you do gyne path or things like that. So
synaptophysin positivity, that's something I would never have thought of.
Yeah, I know, right? And if you hadn't done a STAT6 or CD34, you might not be led towards solitary fibrous tumor at all. The one thing I think to note too there is that GLI1 amplified mesenchymal tumors can also express STAT6. So that's with this morphology, I'm not sure how much overlap there is there, but it might be enough overlap to where you want to consider doing molecular before you pull the trigger on calling it SFT with a STAT6 that's positive. I guess GLI1-ish might be helpful there too.
Hmm. Hey, Will, I might have missed this. Did they do molecular confirmation
They
of
actually
these?
didn't. They did not. That's a good question.
Brendan, why do you ask? Do you see cases that are STAT6 positive but don't have the rearrangement?
No, I mostly just ask because, again, that issue in the soft tissue world that STAT6 is not entirely specific for SFT and can be seen in other mesenchymal neoplasms. I think it can be seen in dedifferentiated liposarcomas, for example, and as Will mentioned, the GLE altered tumors and some other things. And I'm not an expert on STAT6, but anything that looked really odd, I would think would, warrant at least consideration of molecular testing to confirm. They're weird looking tumors in this paper, no doubt. Weird, at least from the standpoint of what SFT usually looks like. They certainly could be SFTs. They probably are. They're, SFTs are common, and these other things would be quite uncommon in the lung, but.
Yeah, and I would have liked if they had done molecular exactly for that reason, because STAT6 is, it's pretty specific, but it's, like you said, it's not perfect.
Thank you.
All right, that's all I have. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much, Will.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thanks so much.